welcome everybody to this bi-monthly conflict-free leadership call hosted by the National Physicians Alliance as part of its Unbranded Doctor Project. It takes place under the Partnership to Advance Conflict-Free Medical Education, affectionately known as the PACME Grant. I'm Rachel DeBolia, facilitator for this call and a board member of the National Physicians Alliance. In my day job, I direct the Universal Healthcare Action Network, and I'm also an ACA Enrollment Navigator. According to our pre-registrations, we have a good mix of physicians and faculty and students from around the country from at least 15 states plus D.C. We had a few more roll in today, so that's really great. And so now, right now, I'm going to ask everyone, since we do have a pretty big crowd on the phone, to please mute your own lines so we can all hear better. And if you haven't done that already, star 6 will do it. And when it gets to the Q&A period, we are going to ask people to email questions, but you can also unmute your line if you want to speak up at that time by pressing star 6 again. So first, a little background on the PACME project. The grant that supports this project stemmed from a settlement regarding the inappropriate marketing of the drug Neurontin. And the partners, in addition to the National Physicians Alliance, are the American Medical Student Association, Community Catalyst, and the Pew Charitable Trust. The goal of the project is to reduce conflicts of interest created by the pharmaceutical industry in the medical profession and in medical research. And we promote a number of approaches to help raise awareness on this issue and build leadership in the medical profession. Our topic tonight is recognizing conflict of interest at medical schools, reducing conflict of interest through curriculum development. And our guest speaker is Sharon Levine, MD, who is the Director and Senior Advisor for Public Policy, Pharmacy, and Professional Development for the Permanente Medical Group of Northern California. Dr. Levine has held multiple leadership roles within the medical group and within Kaiser Permanente nationally, and currently is responsible for clinical education, management training, and leadership development for the group's physicians. Also, government and community relations, health policy and external affairs, and pharmacy policy and drug use management. A board-certified pediatrician, Dr. Levine has held academic appointments at Tufts, and at Georgetown, and spent 2 years as a clinical associate at the National Institutes of Health, Institute of Child Health and Human Development. So tonight, Dr. Levine is going to talk about her role at Kaiser Permanente in helping to establish an organizational culture of professionalism that emphasizes maintaining standards of behavior, including the duty to avoid conflicts of interest. To describe how the physicians there developed and implemented a policy on conflict of interest based on avoiding and eliminating all potential conflicts of interest, and to also discuss how that policy is reinforcing an evidence-based, industry-influence-free environment for clinical decision-making. So let me just say a quick word about the format for this call, for those who are new to these calls. Dr. Levine will speak for about 20 minutes, and before we do Q&A, I'm going to invite NPA's Executive Director, Jean Silver-Eisenstadt, to provide an initial response and to tell us a little bit about NPA's work in this area and resources available. Then following those two presentations, we'll invite everyone to address questions to either of speakers. And given the number of people on this call, as I said before, we would suggest that you email your questions, and you can do this at any time, to Ann Wollison, NPA's Education Director. Her email is ann.wollison@npalliance.net. Ann will compile the questions and perhaps consolidate a few, and we'll try to address all of them. If we run out of time, we will ask our speakers to respond to you after the call. So let me just state that email one more time, ann.wollison@npalliance.net. And now I'd like to invite Ann to say just a few words about NPA's educational programs. Ann?
Hi, Rachel. Thank you very much. And thank you, Dr. Levine, for joining us tonight. And thank you for everybody for joining the call. Just a reminder that there's a whole series of these calls that have taken place over the course of the last 2.5 years, and they are archived, both recordings and notes, on the National Physicians Alliance website, and you can find them at www.npalliance.org/conflict-free. And not only can you find the archived calls, but you can find other events, including National Grand Rounds, that the National Physicians Alliance has organized and sponsored as part of a partnership to advance conflict-free education. And I just want folks to know about a couple events that are coming up in the next couple of months. And one has to do with the release of the American Medical Student Association farm-free card that grades medical institutions, teaching hospitals, and medical schools on their conflict-free policies. The new scorecard was recently released, and there will be a national grand rounds in Chicago in the next couple of months that highlights changes in the scorecard and also how medical schools across the country have been rated. And I just want you to keep your eyes open for an invitation to that national grand rounds. And I also want folks to also be aware, if you're not already, about the National Physicians Alliance annual conference that will take place on October on Friday, October 24th and 25th in New York. On October 24th at 1:30, there will be a national grand round that will feature ProPublica investigative reporter Marcia Allen, whose work includes extensive reporting on steps regarding the National Quality Forum has taken to guard against conflicts of interest in its process for recommending patient safety measures. And again, that conference is going to take place in October. The National Grand Rounds will be recorded nationally, and I just want you to keep your eyes open for an invitation to that because it will be a really interesting call. So I'm going to stop there and ask Rachel to invite our guest speaker to start.
All right. So thank you, Anne. Just a quick reminder, everybody, mute your lines, press star 6. And now, Dr. Levine, we are looking forward to hearing your remarks on recognizing conflict of interest at medical schools, reducing conflict of interest in curriculum development. Welcome.
Thank you. And actually, I think that umbrella title, I'm going to speak to a piece of what falls under that umbrella title. And what I'm going to do tonight, after my conversation with Ann last week, is talk about the journey our medical group went on actually a decade ago to look critically at our environment. And I'm a physician with Kaiser Permanente in Northern California. And each of our, for those of you who aren't familiar with Kaiser Permanente, it's a large integrated delivery system that operates in 8 states and the District of Columbia. But each of those regions is essentially a separate business unit. And my medical group in Northern California has about 8,000 or 8,300 physicians now, 27,000 staff, and a partnership relationship with Kaiser Foundation Health Plan and Hospital. And in 2003, a number of events converged to make us think really hard about taking a serious look at our own environment and, I guess in NPA parlance, decide that we were literally going to scrub the environment to ensure that we created for our patients a place where they could be confident that when clinical decisions were made, when therapeutic recommendations were made, that the only thing that was being brought to bear was the interest of the patient and not relationships or interests of the provider or physician who was making it. And it was the three events that prompted us to move in this direction were, first, in May of 2003, subsequent to the passage of the Medicare Modernization Act, the Office of the Inspector General in Washington issued a guidance to the industry, and that was to everybody in healthcare. Now that Medicare was on the hook for prescription drug costs, there was a very lengthy, what they call a guidance, what we felt was a warning, that the federal government was going to take a very dim view of any relationships or behavior that had the direct or indirect result of raising the cost of prescription drug therapy for the federal government. Almost at the same time, there were several high-profile prosecutions of physicians for out-and-out double-dealing, buying drugs at a deep discount and then submitting false invoices to the federal government for reimbursement. Taft Pharmaceuticals was, I think, one of the vendors involved in this. And then the third event was that we had had a pretty good approach to the pharmaceutical industry. Our P&T committee had done a very good job, really for 20 years, restricting the movement of drug detailers, enforcing the ACCME guidelines for industry funding of CME. But it was definitely a leaky boundary. And we were continually hearing about small efforts to go around it. At the same time, the influence of the device and equipment industry was growing substantially. And we were beginning to hear grumbling from physicians in the medical group about, well, why aren't the stent manufacturers and the OR equipment manufacturers subject to the same restrictions that the drug companies are? And our P&T committee wasn't in a position to take this on. And so with all of these things happening, and I think a real sense at the time that this was only going to become more visible concern in the country, that we had an opportunity to really do something significant in terms of, as I said before, scrubbing the environment. And so this was given to me as an assignment to come up with a policy that would apply to all vendors, not just drug companies, but all vendors, everything from drugs, devices, equipment, consulting firms, big five accounting firms, that any vendor doing business with the organization would be subject to this policy. And again, it was really an effort to say that relationships with vendors were going to be negotiated between the organization and the vendor and not between individual physicians. And we made some decisions along the way that I think have made it much easier to ensure adherence to the policy and not create a web of compliance rules and regulations which would have strangled us. And the first was, as I said, the decision that this would apply to all vendors and that it would apply to everyone in the organization, physicians, nurses, pharmacists, OR techs. So everyone who works for the Permanente Medical Group, and this was initially a medical group policy, not a Kaiser Permanente policy, would be subject to these rules. The second decision we made was that there would be no de minimis exceptions. That there's an old joke that I'm not very good at telling jokes about. We've agreed on the principle, now we're just arguing on the price. And that to put in a $10 or $25 exception would create an opportunity for all kinds of loopholes and arguments around, is it wholesale, is it retail, is it the discounted rate versus what it might appear to be in on a retail website. And we said, no one can accept anything of value from a vendor, gifts, gratuities. And we made the decision that would include things that were given to groups of people, like breakfast for the nurses in the oncology infusion center, or you know, bagels for lunch for the docs in the physician in the pre-op area where the physicians hung out. Again, intentional decision to interrupt what the literature calls the cycle of food, friendship, and flattery that creates a sense of indebtedness and an almost unconscious interest in reciprocating in some way. We eliminated the opportunity for speakers bureau, for consulting arrangements, and for the acceptance of honoraria from any vendor, any for-profit vendor of any kind, but continued to allow physicians who prepared grand rounds and spoke at academic institutions or for non-profit organizations to accept modest honoraria. No vendor-sponsored training. In other words, vendors paying for the expenses for physicians to come and play with a new piece of equipment, a new anesthesia machine, a new imaging machine. That if the equipment committees, the physician-led equipment committees, determined they were interested in a piece of equipment, that the organization would pay for their expenses to travel to the testing lab, and we have done this, and to investigate on their own. And then, if there was a requirement for training associated with equipment that we bought, it had to be explicitly stipulated in the contract. Because one of the things that the OIG expressed concern about is that undeclared benefits or gifts or exchanges of value to them, to the OIG, is an undisclosed discount. And it changes the reported price that the vendor reports in terms of selling the product. And so we're very careful that any vendor-sponsored training, if it was written into the contract, that they would train 27 anesthesiologists on the use of a new anesthesia machine or some orthopedic equipment. It was stipulated, and the value of it had to be stipulated in the contract. And all contracts for services had to be negotiated between the organization and the vendor. So occasionally our medical group, our orthopedic surgeons, will be approached by a vendor who says, we'd really like your expertise. You've published in this area on a new hip joint we're designing and testing. In the past, before this, the orthopedic surgeon would negotiate with the vendor and would provide that consultation or advice after hours on his or her own time and feel like they could keep the honoraria. And we made the decision that no orthopedist, whether or not they were on a purchasing committee, could continue to do this. That if the need was there and the organization determined that there was value in it, then the medical group would contract with Zimmer or with DePue for the physician's time. The physician would be paid his or her salary, and the medical group would be reimbursed by the company for that time. And again, it was about disrupting personal relationships and ensuring that all contact between industry and the physicians in the organization was within a framework of high integrity and where there was complete transparency about what was going on. We do a lot of research. We have a couple of $100 million of research that's done every year, federally funded, NIH funded, Department of Defense funded, and some of it is industry funded. And again, those research contracts have to be written in such a way that the researcher does not get any personal financial benefit or gain from the arrangement with the vendor, and that any meetings or whatever that the researcher goes to, again, are directly related to and necessary for the completion of the research, rather than to curry favor with the researchers by the vendor. And our researchers have been extremely helpful in enforcing this. So it took about 18 months, I would say, from conception to bringing to our board of directors, which is an internal board of physicians who work for the medical group, a policy that was ready for their approval. And we worked pretty closely with, in particular, the proceduralists, who were very concerned that the way the contract was structured would not, in some inadvertent way, cut off their access to cutting-edge technology. So that we needed to ensure that the access was there, but again, that it wasn't about the interests of an individual physician. It was about, is it in the interest of our patients and the organization for us to test, to try, to examine this technology? And physicians who, we made a decision, the physicians who were on the committees that evaluated equipment and drugs, being the P&T committee, for purchase or use, generally were not those who went and sort of scoped out the equipment in the first place. Those things were separated so that we were completely clean on there being no ability for anyone to say contact between Merck or Pfizer or Zimmer had an influence on the clinical equipment or the formulary or on clinician decisions. And after multiple iterations and presentations at each of our medical centers and addressing the concerns of the surgeons and the proceduralists, we agreed upon a policy which our board of directors approved in December of 2004, so we're coming up on the 10th anniversary of the passage of the policy. And when I got this assignment from my boss in 2003 to take this on, I said to him, "Well, this is probably going to be a career-ending move for me because there are a lot of oxes out there that are going to get gored." And he was incredibly supported, and my experience in this was one that I have learned many times over in my role, which is that leadership really matters, and nothing important happens in organizations without committed leadership. And I could not have made this happen if I had not had his staunch support, and his repeating over and over again to physicians who, who quoted to him, industry spends on average $13,000 per physician in the pharmaceutical industry. Somebody else is getting ours. And his insistence that this is about the ethics and professionalism of the practice of medicine. And if we want to attain and aspire to a leadership role in healthcare, then you don't get to pick and choose those things that are easy to lead in. Sometimes you have to do the right thing, even if it's hard. And convincing 8,300 physicians that no more Starbucks gift cards, no more mugs, no more pens, was the right thing to do. And there was a lot of grumbling during this period of time, but ultimately, I would say within 6 months of the passage of the policy, the tone in the organization began to shift substantially. in what had become, what had begun as something, you know, I personally felt like I had to convince 8,300 doctors one at a time that this was the right thing to do, had become a real source of pride in the organization, particularly as, you know, there's more and, was more and more coverage of conflicts of interest influencing influencing decisions. Coverage by the New York Times or the FDA panel that approved Vioxx and the other COX-2 inhibitors, and how the vote would have been different had the people who had financial relationships with Merck and with Pfizer not been on the advisory panel that made the recommendations. And so there was a lot of coverage during between 2004 and 2010 around, I would say, swamps of conflict within the profession and within industry. And it has, as I said, become a real source of pride within the organization about the fact that we were early to do this and that we have done it pretty much, I would say, with, you know, in an almost seamless fashion. It took about, I would say it took about a year to unearth all the things that had happened or happening that fell outside the policy. And there was no, we weren't putting anybody in the stocks or publicly shaming people. And what's happened subsequent to that is because we have embedded the policy in our required annual compliance training. And so there's no excuse for anyone not understanding what the policy is. And what it's done is when there are questions, when people get offers, when they get inquiries from, you know, based on you are a world-class expert in X, you know, we would really appreciate your advice on this work we're doing, products we need to bring, we're interested in bringing to market, you know, and how we could make it better to meet your needs. People do not hesitate to ask whether or not, is this an acceptable engagement? So there's no, I think we've seen the disappearance of efforts to hide things and really an openness to say, I'm not sure this is okay, so I wanted to check. This work went from, I think, something I dreaded taking on to one of the things when I finish my career I will actually be the most proud of. So I think I have used up my 20 minutes. Oh, just let me make a couple of comments about training. Kaiser Permanente in Northern California, we train about 450 graduate medical education residents a year, and we probably have 150 or 200 medical students who do rotations through our clinical environment. And the part of their orientation is about our conflict of interest policy. And so they are training and learning in an environment where professionalism and conflict-free medical practice is made both explicit at the beginning of their time with us, and they see it in action during the course of their rotations and their clerkships. And it's part of the faculty training that we do with our teaching faculty every year. And I think I'll stop there and see if there are any questions.
Great, thank you. That was terrific. That is a journey. All right, so I think what we're going to do is ask Jean Silver-Eisenstadt, MTA's Executive Director, if she'd like to start us off with an initial response, question, comment, and then we'll throw it open for Q&A. And remember, folks, you can email your questions to ann.wolosson, W-O-L-O-S-O-N, at npalliance.net. So, Jean?
Yeah, thank you. Well, I just want to kick off by saying that just an inspirational story to hear, and just what a role model you are in your leadership on this. And I'm just struck by the way you tell the story. It sounds like it sort of flowed easily, took a year and a half of meetings, but bit by bit, and it just was rather easy. And I guess it begs the question, why hasn't the rest of medicine figured this out and done this, even with all the scandals and with the pressure of these, you know, patient harms and the front page of the Times and scandal after scandal? What are the obstacles that are still out there, and what can groups like the National Physicians Alliance do most effectively to help keep moving the needle on institutional reform?
Well, I think that, you know, it's almost a classical story of change management, cultural change, and it begins with senior leadership. And I think when we talk about professionalism, if there isn't clear modeling of whatever the desired behavior is at the very top, and you know, repetition, and no special deals, and no, well, you know, it would be nice if we could do that, but we really don't want to pick off this funder who's, you know, willing to maybe give us $40 million to build a research institute or research lab, so we'll make an exception for this. And, you know, one of the things that has allowed the profession to kind of slither along on this is confusing disclosure with freedom from conflict. And while some people argue that disclosure is an anesthetic, or antiseptic rather, that sterilizes the environment, I just don't think that's the case. And I think that, you know, people, but requiring disclosure, particularly in a situation where the disclosure is hidden in an appendix, or, you know, or you see in a journal notation, you know, the author's disclosures can be found on the website.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's, disclosure is a small first step, but it's almost unreasonable to ask patients or to ask practicing clinicians to evaluate one by one the size and scope, and that's not disclosed, of the financial relationship and whether or not it could have had an influence on, you know, what's written. And I think the responsibility for this really does rest within institutions that set themselves up as models. And, you know, front and center for that is academic medical centers. And academic medical centers set themselves out there as, almost by definition, as an exemplar. And they hold the very precious responsibility of training the next generation of physicians. And the trainees on the faculty, you know, the trainees can be no more professional, if you will, than the faculty. And the faculty is not going to, you know, not going to live by professional standards that are more rigorous than those that the institution insists on. So it's the dean, and whatever the governance of the institution is, don't both model and insist on a level of integrity that truly says self-interest and self-dealing just isn't going to be acceptable here. Then it's a hard row to hoe for individuals to, you know, to operate in an environment like that where there isn't that kind of leadership.
Did you find unexpected allies along the way in this work?
Yes, and they're critically important. In addition to leadership, having local champions who got it and who were willing to stand up and you know, represent to their colleagues why this is important, particularly when they were credible, you know, credible clinicians, highly respected and highly valued. And eventually, actually, the most unexpected champions were the spine surgeons. Spine surgeons and orthopedic surgeons who, once they were confident that this wasn't going to, you know, interfere with clinical practice and interfere with them actually remaining respected within their profession, within the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgery, and it wasn't going to cut off access to cutting-edge information, if you will. They became rabid champions of the policy, including trying to influence the AAOS, which has done some pretty remarkable work, actually, compared to some of the specialty associations.
So that's a case study of individual people becoming champions for something that really hurt their own personal pocketbooks.
That's another issue. Our physicians are salaried, so they're physicians in the Kaiser Permanente are not billing with a markup on drugs or devices, or they're not. You know, they're salaried. They're well paid, but they're salaried. And so I suppose it's a little bit different if you're in fee-for-service practice and you have an opportunity to augment your income because of some relationship with a vendor. It doesn't make it right, but it does invoke the famous Upton Sinclair quote of, it's hard to make someone understand something if his livelihood depends on him not understanding it.
Mm-hmm.
So, to some extent, it should have been easier in Kaiser Permanente because while it, you know, it eliminated the trips to Puerto Rico and for the urologists and the dinners at five-star restaurants in San Francisco, ultimately, their income wasn't affected by it.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's see if we have some questions from the other participants on the call. Anne, do you have some for us?
I do. Can everybody hear me all right?
Yes. Somebody has a dog barking background, and it's not mine. So *6 to mute your line, please. I also heard a little typing there, and it's great you're taking notes, but you might want to mute your line. Go ahead, Anne.
Okay. So I have a couple of questions for Dr. Levine, and the first is, you talked about studying this over 10 years ago with Kaiser, and the question is, how has the organization responded to more recent policy developments, such as the ACA and the Physicians Payment Sunshine Act? Are they promoting the open payment system, encouraging providers to check the data for accuracy, et cetera?
So it's a great question because, I say quite confidently, you know, I think we've got really good adherence to this policy. But the data that industry provides will be a check on that.
Mm-hmm.
And so our compliance folks are going to be, you know, looking at that database, the data that's published, to ensure that, in fact, any names that show up there are in fact part of a legitimate research research engagement. And that is likely to be where permanent physicians show up, is if you are the principal investigator on industry-funded research, you will appear in the database. But we are absolutely going to use that as a check on how good our adherence is. And we've made that, you know, physicians understand that, they know that. So we're going to be checking, and I'm pretty sure many of our docs are going to be checking to make sure that their names aren't in there. One of the challenges, and we've already seen this with the settlement with industry required a bunch of the manufacturers to publish data on their own websites. And I can't remember, ProPublica.
ProPublica, that's right.
ProPublica reported on this, and we went through and checked, and in fact there were errors in that, errors that physicians who had had literally no contact with industry's names were in there. We were able to correct that, and there are a lot of John Smith and Michael Wong who practice medicine in the country. And so the name confusion, I think, it has been one source of error in the databases. But in any event, it'll be an interesting and I think fun exercise for us to be sure that, in fact, we're as good as we think we are, and that we have the chance to correct any errors that are in there.
Right.
We were thrilled about the Sunshine Act, actually.
That's great. Thank you. I have a follow-up to that, but I'm trying to keep things sort of in order. So you had mentioned the importance of leadership, and the question is, what influenced the leader to take such bold action at Kaiser, and did the board play a leading or following role? And was this exclusively top down, or was there some bottom up influence as well in terms of the early developments at Kaiser?
Good question. So the work was initiated at the request of my boss, who's the CEO, the plastic surgeon, who's the CEO of our medical group. But to implement a policy requires that the board approve it. And the board is made up of physicians from the medical group representing multiple specialties, and in many ways they reflect the concerns of their constituents, their colleagues. And so while there was some immediate support from some of the, it's a big board, 39 physicians running this enterprise, and I would say in the beginning there were some early enthusiasts. There were some folks who saw probably a good thing, but were concerned about how they could convince their colleagues back at the medical center. And there were skeptics. And again, like any change effort, it took direct work with the skeptics, direct work with those who were most concerned about their professional lives being somehow constrained by this, and proving that wasn't going to be the case, making some changes. One of the tactics I used was to the first version that I brought to our board was pretty strict, pretty rigorous, and so there were things in there I knew that would have to be modified, and the willingness to change them and modify them was very helpful in terms of looking around, being flexible, to be honest. So it was and by December of 2004. It was, the policy was passed unanimously by the board, with one exception. We had one abstention and 38 votes to make this our policy.
Wow.
And, the other piece around that, there had been physicians, I'd say a sizable minority of physicians in the medical group who for years had been saying we should stop accepting money for CME from industry. And part of this policy was essentially cut off any vendor's interest in giving us money for CME. So one of the things we did was to budget within our own medical group budget to replace the industry funding for CME with our own operating dollars. It meant that there weren't going to be any more conferences in Hawaii. But, you know, we have a very high-quality Department of Continuing Medical Education that puts on literally thousands of hours of high-quality CME for our physicians, and we're just now funding all of that internally.
Well, that's great.
You got some more there for us, Anne?
I do. And this, you know, would go to Dr. Levine and perhaps Jean, or if there are any other techie partners on the phone, they may want to respond to this too. This is the subject line was a difficult question, and I do think this is it may be easier to respond than actually have to be the person doing it, but I'll read it out loud. I've recently noticed unethical conduct by other physicians. It is significant enough to warrant reporting to the Board of Medicine, and I'm reasonably certain that doing so is my responsibility. I've never done this before. I'm dreading it and don't know how to do it. Where can I find guidance on how to describe this conduct and what to consider when deciding about reporting it?
So I'm also on the Medical Board of California. I sit on the Medical Board of California. And there is, and I believe this is true in every state, there is a confidential mechanism. There's a mechanism for confidential reporting to the medical board. And it sure sounds from the question like the questioner is anxious about this, but in his or her heart feels pretty sure that this is something that the board ought to investigate. And there is a way of doing that, which if there's concern about identity disclosure, to do it confidentially. And when the boards receive a complaint, they have a requirement, they have to investigate the complaint. And I would say if the physicians in question are operating within a hospital environment or within an institutional environment, I would hope that behavior was simultaneously reported to the leadership of the institution. Because if the institution should have been aware of or should have known that the behavior is occurring and did nothing, then the institution is liable.
So did I understand that in at least where you are, there's a confidentiality choice to reporting?
There's a number. You call them. You can find us on, at least on our medical board website. You can do it electronically. You can call a phone number and leave a confidential message without necessarily identifying yourself. And those complaints are taken very seriously. It's kind of like a compliance hotline. And I suspect the staff at the medical board in whatever state this is in would be happy to have a conversation to confirm whether or not they felt that this was something that they needed to investigate if the questioner has doubts about it or is uncertain about it, but it doesn't sound like that.
That's great. Thank you. I do have a couple more questions. And this is a two-part question. If I'm hearing Dr. Levine correctly, would zero Kaiser Permanente doctors be on the Sunshine Act list? So that's the first part of the question. And then the second part of the question is, why do you think that the Pew report from, and you may, this may be too specific, from December 2013 had an out for medical devices, but not for pharma,
for the recommendation in these two domains, specifically medical devices for education consultation is okay, but not for pharma. And again, that might be a little too specific, but getting to the first question, presumably, is it true that Kaiser Permanente docs would not be on the Sunshine Act list?
As I said before, my hope would be that the only names that appear there are names of physicians who are involved in research with under legitimate research agreements. But I don't actually have that information now, and our compliance folks are actively going through that, through the information, and preparing to check against our database of physicians. And I think Jean may be able to speak, maybe may want to speak about the Pew report. Jean?
Jean? I think the questioner honed in on one of the topics that I think was one of the most difficult and contentious discussion points among the group that was hashing out those policies. And it was a consensus document. I think it really, there was an awareness that there would be pushback of the kind that you described, that the fear that it was impractical to provide training to the cutting-edge technologies, to the devices that had to be demonstrated in the ORs, where folks are, if the device reps aren't right there doing the training, sort of logistically and practically, how would that be accomplished? And I was really fascinated to hear you talk about that and how it has worked at Kaiser and how some of the folks who were most concerned on that front have become the biggest champions. So, I mean, I think that the Pew report is trying to put forward recommendations that will be received as a very high bar, but not pie in the sky. I don't know how, broadly across medical institutions, a model like Kaiser's will be received as pie in the sky. I mean, obviously, it's doable because it's being done. But I think, the recommendations that in that Pew report were an aspirational document that worked hard to stay in the realm of achievable so as not to scare everyone off and simply be dismissed. I don't know. Sharon, do you?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, not everybody agreed with that exception. And as Jean said, there are legitimate reasons for vendor reps to be in the OR, particularly when a new piece of equipment or device is being used in the beginning. There are behaviors, though, that they are trained to try and do that need to be controlled, such as, we've stopped this many times, that we have a rule that says you can't try and introduce a piece of equipment or an implant that isn't on our formulary, our device formulary. And so we have nurses who have overheard conversations where the vendor rep says, well, looking at this procedure, I got something in the trunk of my car that I think that would work even better than this piece of equipment that, you've got here in your hands. You want me to go get it? I won't charge you for it. And that's just, they're trying to, get agreement on product extensions and identify champions for getting more equipment or more devices onto our formularies. And so that kind of behavior gets them literally thrown out, not the company necessarily, but the individual. So a vendor rep who engages in that kind of behavior, there are consequences to them. And if the institution is willing to enforce the consequences, you can stop the behavior. As Jean said, this was a diverse group of individuals on this task force, all of whom are supporters of conflict-free medicine, but with very different perspectives, I would say, on how feasible and how quickly the changes can be instituted in academic medical centers in particular. And, you know, they, someone, the dean at Stanford at the time, Phil Pizzo, was absolutely clear that, you know, he was going to go as far as was required. He had no hesitation about doing it. And there were others from, you know, Harvard who weren't so sure. You know, didn't want to ruffle feathers. And so, as Dean said, it was a consensus document. Everyone, and there was a minority, I guess there was a minority report that didn't get published.
I think, Andy, we might have time for one more question, if it's quick.
Let me just think. I have a couple here. And one you already answered, but it is just as a real quick follow-up to what you just mentioned, what you just talked about. I actually have two more that I want to include. Do you know, and I'm assuming they do based on everything you said, does Kaiser have specific protocols regarding conflict of interest for physicians and consultants, if you just touched on this a moment ago, involved in decision-making and recommendations regarding prior authorization, formularies, or preferred drug lists related to the coverage that Kaiser provides? And it sounds like they probably do, but maybe you want to just talk a little more about that?
So we have a formulary. The formulary is created within each of our medical groups by physicians in the medical group. And it's a very distributed bottom-up process. We have probably 600 physicians in our medical group in Northern California who are involved either as specialty consultants to the P&T committee or members of the P&T committee. We have 19 medical centers, each of which has a P&T committee, with representatives from multiple specialties, and then a regional P&T committee with the representative from each of the 19 P&T committees, and then cardiology consultants to the P&T committee. So we physicians create the formulary and make decisions like all P&T committees based on quality, safety, and efficacy of the drugs. And then when there is more than one option, relative cost effectiveness. We don't use prior authorization. So we do a lot of retrospective review. We're a data-rich environment, and physicians get unblinded reports about their prescribing, formulary adherent prescribing, use of brand drugs when generics are available, depending on what drug initiatives we've got going on at the moment. And it's a very, it's a participatory process. I would say it's very effective, but not necessarily as efficient as having a small central committee making the decision. But once the decisions are made, we have really good adherence to the formulary because it's created by clinicians for their clinician colleagues. These are all practicing physicians doing this.
All right, I think our hour is up, and I suspect there's more questions there pending. So, Dr. Levine, is it okay if I share your email with people to email you directly?
Sure.
Okay, and it's Sharon.Levine, your name, at kp.org, right?
Correct.
That's simple. We didn't have time to get to it, I think it's fine to email Dr. Levine, or you can email Becky Martin, who you got the email about from this call today, and we'll make sure she gets questions. All right, I want to thank everyone for joining us tonight. We will have an audio recording posted as well as written notes shortly on the conflict-free portion of the NPE Alliance and National Physicians Alliance website, along with all the other notes and audio recordings of our previous calls. I don't know that we have the date for our next call yet. Do we, Ann?
Not yet. We're checking with speakers, so we will let you know as soon as
we'll
possible.
We'll get that out shortly. Yep. It'll be probably sooner rather than later, maybe in September.
Definitely towards the end of September. Yep.
Right. Okay, great. So thank you all. Thank you, Dr. Levine. Thank you, Jean. And thank you, everybody, for joining us tonight. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Thanks, everyone.